This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
They're going to have to move this trial out of this community, I would think. Don't you think?
You know, Stacey, there has been, my understanding is that there may have even already been a motion to change venue. Because, yeah, it is such a close, tight-knit community. Everybody and knows everybody, and they're all talking and that kind of thing. And so it wouldn't surprise me if they try to move this case out of that very limited jurisdiction to somewhere else where folks are less personally affected. They have less personal connections to the case and perhaps even some of the parties and witnesses in the case. So it would be a sensible motion to file to change that venue.
There's so much in this case that we just don't know about. And there's so many rumors in this case and so many just horrific accusations in this case where it makes it what it is. And everybody speculates, well, was he pushed to this because of some of those rumors or because of that information? Or are they facts or are they not facts? And then we don't know. And what happened after the shooting might be just as important as what happened before. I mean, hours after his arrest, Stines was evaluated at the jail. The intake report, and this is some new information, describes him as actively psychotic, different than, I guess, what we saw in that video that we were just watching. Initially disoriented, combative, paranoid, even pepper sprayed by the staff. Wow. Because and unable to understand his charges off the bat. He was started on, I'm bad at medication names, Risperdione, I believe, and antipsychotic medication is what they gave him. It stands in sharp contrast to what the detective told the grand jury, that Stines had been in the right mind when he killed the judge. I mean, it's a gap. It's now in the defense's strongest weapon, it seems here. How do you, as a defense counsel, how do you leverage something like that in a jail intake report that so clearly contradicts the state's narrative?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it looks like that might be the most viable defense here is kind of an insanity defense or some kind of mental health mitigator. And the fact that the prosecution really told the jury kind of matter-of-factly, hey, he was fine. He was in he was of sound mind when this happened. Don't worry about that. Mm-hmm. Just sort of goes to show how one-sided that grand jury process can be. So with defense, they're going to get mental health evaluations to try to get an expert to say that the shooter did not know what he was doing and could not ascertain between right and wrong. And so certainly some fodder for defense as we move forward. And if I'm defense, I'm trying to bring up the fact that the prosecution left that out of the grand jury proceedings. I'm not sure if a judge will allow that at trial, but I'd want to show that hypocrisy on behalf of the government.
I mean, as a prosecutor, do you try to argue that the psychosis set in after the fact, not before?
I think that's a clever avenue to explore, because certainly some horribly traumatic event like shooting somebody you know at your work inside a courthouse who's a judge could have a severe impact on one's psyche. And so if those psychotic issues came to light only after the alleged crime was committed, it would not constitute an insanity defense and may not even be terribly relevant. So if I'm the prosecutor, that's kind of the road I'm going down.
Yeah, I mean,
that medication, by the way, Tony, that medication is typically used for schizophrenia. They also use it for bipolar disorder. So not sure exactly
what. Yeah, they gave him something. I mean, in that you know, heat of the moment of what's going on here, let's get this guy calm. And so that seems to be, you know,
it must. And to me, my familiarity with this is that you wouldn't necessarily use it acutely, but maybe maybe that's something you would use if somebody is having a meltdown of some sort, for lack of a better term.
It's you know, you could talk to one doctor, one's going to go, yeah, give him that. The other's going to be like, why would you give him that?
Exactly. You know, exactly. So yeah, it may be, it's a long acting injection or tablet. So who knows how they would go about using it, but clearly they felt they needed to.
Yeah. Yeah. the defense is going to be going with the insanity defense. They're going to argue that Steins wasn't capable of understanding what he was doing. Prosecutors, of course, have pushed back, saying that he knew exactly what he was doing, and they're demanding a second mental health evaluation. I don't know how that would play in today after all this. I mean, the evaluation, I think, at the moment of the crime would be the most important. The defense is resisting that, calling it a stalling tactic. It kind of sets up a very high-stake battle here, not whether Steins pulled the trigger, but whether he was legally responsible for this for the action of what he did. He clearly did pull the trigger, but how tough is that to mount a successful insanity defense in a case where you literally have him pulling the trigger?
It is exceedingly difficult. You know, in movies, we see insanity defenses and stuff, and they prevail. But in real life, it is very hard to win on some kind of insanity defense, especially when you have this video. The video is going to be problematic for the defense, obviously, in part because it shows the Sheriff Steins sort of acting in a normal fashion. He's not hysterical. He's not falling over. He's not accosting somebody. He's sort of going in there in what appears to be a rather composed fashion, and then taking a gun, pointing it at somebody and shooting them. And so defense is going to have a hard time saying, hey, this guy didn't know what he was doing, when the video kind of details his actions and one can infer his mental state from that video, perhaps.
Yeah. Overlaying the entire case, there's these crazy, disturbing allegations. And I don't want to say they're crazy, because it seems a lot of people believe them to be true. But they are allegations of systematic abuse inside the courthouse. A deputy was convicted of raping a woman inside the chambers. Convicted. It's not that's not a rumor. That was an actual conviction. Federal lawsuits claim multiple officials coerced women into sex in exchange for leniency. Some witnesses have even said Judge Mullins was part of that culture. A lot of people claiming that the chambers were like a brothel, basically. Yeah. He's not around to defend himself anymore, obviously. But, I mean, these are pretty horrible allegations. Defense filings suggest otherwise, though. Steins, as sheriff, may have been facing deposition questions about all of it. In fact, he was questioned right before this. Whether fact or rumor, it's a backdrop that adds a lot of weight to this story. I mean, how do these systematic corruption allegations affect a case like this? I mean, can the defense weave them into the narrative of the mental collapse? I mean, with a lot of them being rumor, you do have some verified fact here, but I mean, it's quite a story.
Oh, heck yeah. I mean, it really adds a possible alleged sinister aspect to this entire saga here. You know, if I'm defense, I'm arguing that, hey, this sheriff was by the book. He was a law and order guy. He's an upstanding dude. And he saw this just egregious corruption within the place where he works, the jurisdiction he works, and that drove him to just lose it. He couldn't control himself after that. If I'm the prosecution, what I'm saying is, hey, this sheriff, you know, bought into some rumors that are likely not true, at least in terms of how expansive that they've been portrayed, and that was his motive. Actually, he knew what he was doing. He was getting back at this system that he thought was corrupt, and that would show that someone, you know, kind of has knowledge of their conduct and has a conscious objective in terms of what they're doing, which cuts against an insanity defense. So I think you could play both ways.
As a prosecutor, do you try to wall that off, or do you risk losing credibility if you act like it doesn't exist and it's just this story off on the side that the defense is telling?
I think as a prosecutor, you absolutely try to get it excluded. You say, hey, this has largely not been substantiated. This is a red herring. This is going to distract the jury. It's going to mislead them. The jury's going to focus on something other than whether this defendant shot this judge in the face, you know? And so if I'm the prosecution, that's the argument I'm making. But certainly that could go awry, because if the judge disagrees and the jury sees the prosecution trying to push that to the side and the defense is bringing it to the forefront, that might indicate to the jury that the prosecution is withholding information. They're hiding something. They're hiding something nefarious. And juries don't like that.
How deep do you think this whole thing is within the system? Is this something that could go on with just a couple of people, or do you think that the entire department needs to be dealt with here? That people have rumblings, they knew something was up.
Yeah, you know, we sort of like to have this perspective in society that, hey, the court system and police, you know, by and large, they're doing their best and they're above board. And all of these, you know, sinister accusations are just sort of rumors and salacious statements. But unfortunately, this corruption does exist. I'm not saying it necessarily has been proven in this jurisdiction, but you look at other jurisdictions where there was a judge, I forget exactly his name, but he was convicted of essentially colluding with juvenile prisons and sending kids to prison when they shouldn't have been sent there for money.
That.
So these things happen. And as dark and horrible as they may seem, they can be a reality. So if I'm defense, I'm interviewing every single person who might have some knowledge of these salacious accusations.
But how difficult is that going to be? Or is it impossible at a certain point? Because you're talking about going into the literal institution that decides what is going to come and go in terms of accountability. They police themselves to a certain extent of what you're right. going to find out. So how do you get in there? How do you get this information? Because if the allegations are true, this runs deep and the whole damn thing is corrupt. And there's someone here, there's someone there, there's someone over there. We're in that chain of information, doesn't want that information to get to you.
Tony, there are so many hurdles in finding the truth of what happened here. And one of those hurdles is, you know, you can interview the deputies. They're not going to talk to you. They're not going to give a statement to you if you're a defense counsel. You can try to interview the alleged victims if you can identify them. Mm-hmm. That's going to be hard. Just identifying, even if you do identify them. My understanding is that some of the folks might have a fear of retaliation. They might say, hey, gosh, in this small community, I don't want to talk about this, sex for leniency corruption scheme that was going on in my courthouse because, you know, one of the deputies is my neighbor over there. And so it's going to be very difficult getting to the bottom of it.
Well, and you'd also probably have people who are maybe embarrassed about it if they participated in it and said, okay, I'll do that for leniency. Obviously, they are a victim as well, but at the same point, may not be something that they want to, they're exactly proud of that this happened and wouldn't want to have that information in the public.
Oh, 100%. I mean, especially when we're talking about a small community, because those folks come forward, you know, what incentive do they have to come forward? What do they have to gain? What is their payoff if they were to publicly out themselves as having agreed to sex with some sort of public official or law enforcement agent in exchange for getting a better deal on their case? That doesn't look good for them, and they don't have a lot to gain. And so there's a disincentive for them to come forward, making it even more difficult to learn precisely what happened in this courthouse and in this jurisdiction.
Well, you have to run into, you know, Aunt Betty at the deli counter, and she's giving you the side eye like, oh, I know what you did. I mean, these small towns, that's something I learned when I got into radio. I started in small towns. Everybody knows everything. And I came from Minneapolis where nobody knew anything about anybody. So, you know, you walk into a building and, oh my goodness, everybody knows your business. Yeah, it's really intimidating.
You don't like getting the side eye when she's dishing up your broccoli salad there. Like, I'll take a little bit more of the raisins in that. That'd be love. Like, I know what you did.
It's the whole thing.
What comes next, Jeremy? I mean, as it stands right now, Mickey Steins, he's sitting in custody without bond. Prosecutors say that they got a lot of evidence, the video, forensic witness testimony still being processed. They want more mental health evaluations. Defense wants the indictment dismissed outright. A change of venue may be on the horizon. I mean, what began as this unthinkable crime, the sheriff killing the judge, I mean, it's spiraling into a referendum here on mental illness, corruption, and the credibility of the system itself. however this plays out, it's not just going to decide the Stein's fate. It's going to decide how much this community can trust itself and its own courts and the people that they have in there. What's the biggest obstacle right now for the prosecution?
For the prosecution, one of the biggest obstacles is certainly the mental health piece, the possible insanity defense. That's likely the road that defense is going to go down. When you're looking at this, I think everyone was so shocked by the factual allegations. This sheriff who works with this judge, they're buddy. They work in the same courthouse. They're involved in the same cases. And so why in the world would he go in and just shoot this judge dead in his chambers? That gives rise to the speculation, hey, was something going on inside this guy's mind? And that's a pretty intuitive inference for some jurors to draw. And so the prosecution's going to have to undercut that by sort of showing, if they can, that this judge was methodical. The sheriff was methodical. They're going to want to look into what happened, what the sheriff was doing up until this happened, in the days preceding it. Was he, running around the highway naked, or was he doing his job and appeared of sound mind? These are questions the jury's going to want to know. The prosecution's got to look into that.
Would it help if you were running around naked in the street? I mean, does that help your defense in any way?
Oh, it would certainly help the defense. Yeah, it would be consistent with someone who is insane, who can't really appreciate what they're doing, doesn't have knowledge of what's happening, is not able to ascertain between right and wrong. So if there is sort of that build up in a way that suggests mental health issues, that certainly inures to the benefit of the defense.
Stacey, you draw the line between a mental health issue and a free spirit.
Well, Stacey, I was just going to ask, you got plans for later today, or what's going on?
Yeah, I'm looking at my watch. Like, come on, you guys, it's a nice day. I got things to do.
It's time to go feel that fresh fall breeze.
Let's go, baby.
Yeah. If you're advising the defense, what's the best path forward right now? The dismissal, insanity plea? I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the insanity defense is important because, look, it's not a whodunit. You can't say it wasn't your dude.
No.
It's not a what happened. We have a video of what happened. It's really why it happened. And when we're looking at why it happened, we're in the neighborhood of mental health defenses and certainly an insanity defense. They've got to look into that, and they're going to want to interview everybody who was around Stein's, especially in the weeks and days leading up to this event, because those folks might have critical information as to Stein's mental stability or lack thereof building up to this horrible shooting.
Yeah, lots of questions in this and still not a lot of answers. I think even more questions after the grand jury information came out, because it just points to more weirdness in this whole thing of, is there cover up? It looks like there likely could be cover up. There looks like there's reason for there to be cover up. But then you have all this over here. What happened to this man that this seemed to be the best path forward? It's never justified, but how the hell did he get there? Was there a mental break? And that's the big question I think everyone's going to be wanting to get to at the end of the day. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight into this and all the cases that we cover here on the program. If you want to comment on any of the cases that we cover here on the program, be sure to press subscribe wherever it is you're downloading, number one. And then YouTube, that's a great place to comment on our program and give us your thoughts, your opinions. We would love to hear them, but please do press that subscribe button. For Todd, for Stacey, for all of us here at the Hidden Killers podcast, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.